RN.
Science. Environment.
Media.
Design.
Music.
Technology.
Hello, how are you? Natasha Mitchell, looking forward to your company on RN for the next hour of your morning. Hope it's a good looking day ahead for you. Stay in touch throughout the show, won't you? Text us on 0418 226 576. That's 0418 226 576. Meaty one to start with today, and you might want to get in touch. Or there's Twitter and Facebook too. And we'll kick straight into it today with a controversial story that goes to the heart of the human project. And to the heart of science, business, medicine, it's all wrapped up in a big legal and ethical tangle. Because should companies be able to patent bits of you, your biology, your genes, the very stuff that makes us human, and claim them as effectively their own? We're each made up of some 25,000 genes. Most we share, but of course, different variations or mutations in our genes make us each uniquely who we are. Some can increase our susceptibility to different diseases, though, too. So did you catch the landmark ruling late last week where the Australian Federal Court concluded that a US biotech company, Myriad Genetics, and one of their licensees, an Australian company called Genetic Technologies, can legitimately hold the patent for a gene called BRCA1 or BRCA1. This is one of the two main breast cancer susceptibility genes. Particular mutations in this gene can dramatically increase a woman's risk of breast and ovarian cancer. So this is important. So much so that some women with a history of breast and ovarian cancer in their family have even elected to have mastectomies upon finding out that they have the relevant gene mutations. What Myriad did is develop a genetic test some years ago now for the relevant mutations in the BRCA genes to consider the wider consequences of this very significant ruling. I'm joined this morning by Sally Crossing. She's spokesperson for Cancer Voices Australia. They're the cancer advocacy group who launched the legal challenge against Myriad and the Australian licensee of this test. And they're now petitioning Federal Parliament to change the Patents Act. Welcome, Sally.
Good morning.
And we also have with us Emeritus Professor David Weisbrot. He's a former president of the Australian Law Reform Commission and chaired two very relevant inquiries here, the Gene Patenting and Human Health Inquiry, and also another on genetics and privacy. David, thanks for joining us again on Life Matters.
Pleasure, Natasha.
And I must say, in just a moment, we'll be joined by a spokesperson from the biotech industry in Victoria. She's rushing from an event at the moment to join us. Sally, I'll start with you. Why is Cancer Voices opposed to a company having the patent on these breast cancer genes? What's the basis of your legal challenge? And we'll go into the detail of that patent in a bit.
Well, we're concerned from the sort of general point of view, as well as the breast cancer specific point of view, that if companies can are allowed to patent bits of our bodies, as you put it so well, this can really have a huge impact. I mean, lots and lots of genes have been patented, unfortunately. So there's an ethical thing where, you know, most people don't even know that patents are. You can have a patent on part of your body, and when they hear about it, as we've heard over the last few days, they're extremely concerned. So there's a public interest issue here. And then there's a practical implication for people with cancer.
What is the public interest concern?
Well, should we allow under our legislation the ability for there to be commercial interests can monopolise access to bits of human genetic material.
What is the concerns for the people that you represent, and that is people with cancer or survivors of cancer?
We're concerned that if we want to check whether our genes have this particular mutation that the case was about, but it could apply much, as I said, much more broadly, that we can access the tests very quickly and not expensively. At the moment, if you're lucky, you can be tested by a familial cancer unit in a hospital, or sometimes they're called genetics units, and even that, although free, is not necessarily very quick. Or you have to go through a commercial process. where there are questions about, well, obviously the cost, the time, and the quality.
So you're concerned that the BRCA gene tests will become prohibitively expensive for patients?
Yes, expensive and slow, and you really need to know these things to make these sort of agonising decisions as to whether you're going to have a double mastectomy or any other sort of major surgical choice, but also sort of what ongoing treatment you might consider.
But why,
and your family too, of course.
Why would the test become more expensive? I mean, certainly there was a controversy about this some years ago where the Australian licensee of the test that Myriad Genetics has developed decided to enforce the patent, and they were going to, and they took the case up with Public Facilities who were doing the test and said, no, sorry, we hold the patent. But there was such a public outcry that they then agreed to freely allow public hospitals and facilities to do the test. So that's been sorted.
Well, yeah.
You would hope.
It's interim. It's very interim. I mean, they responded to the public outcry, and we're very much hoping they'll respond even further to this one. But the trouble is, at the moment, nobody actually knows whether the patent is going to be, when or whether the patent will be applied. So people need certainty, not only patients, but also researchers who are using the material.
What are your concerns for the implications for cancer research? This is another prong that you've been campaigning on.
Yes, that's true. No, well, researchers tell us that, again, it's an access thing for fast, easy, quick access to material. It's much faster, quicker, and easier if there isn't the spectre of monopoly patents hanging over.
Let me come to Professor David Weisbrot. David, how significant is this ruling, this Australian ruling, to uphold the Myriad patent on this gene in your mind? And we'll dig into the details of what the patent actually means, because it's fascinating.
Yeah, well, it is significant, and it's more significant in principle, I think, than it is in the specific instance. As you said, when the ALRC started, the Australian Law Reform Commission started its inquiry in 2003, looking at the issue of gene patenting in human health, and also I should give a lot of credit to the ABC, which radio and television, which also helped to shine the spotlight on this issue. GTG backed off appropriately.
So this is the Australian company who holds the license to this test.
That's right. And they said they would give the patent, basically, their words, as a gift to the Australian people. And that was 10 years ago. So we've had 10 years of non-intervention. There was a little bit of backsliding in 2008 when the company said to the stock exchange that it was going to begin enforcing its valuable patent, and there was a bit of a, you know, brouhaha, and the ACCC and others got involved, and they backed off again just a few months later. So they never actually backtracked on their original decision not to enforce the patent.
Okay, David, let's just look at what this patent actually covers.
Yeah.
Because, you know, people's understanding will be that a patent is meant to cover an invention, not the discovery of something that occurs in nature, like a gene, like the BRCA 1 and 2 genes that are so relevant here and can increase a woman's risk of breast and ovarian cancer substantially. But this distinction between an invention and a discovery of something natural was the key sticking point in this case, wasn't it?
It was, and it's why I disagree with the judgment. I was mildly surprised, but very disappointed with the judgment. It seems to me that you know, what you got here is a discovery rather than an invention. The Patents Act requires that there be an invention for it to be patentable, and that the invention has to be novel, inventive, and innovative. And while there may have been innovation in this, it seems to me it's clearly a discovery. What the scientists have done, and a terrific bit of science, was to work out the association between those particular mutations and the possible onset of breast cancer, or a risk, elevated risk of breast cancer.
So they did that original work, is that what you're saying?
At the University of Utah, yeah.
But what does the patent actually cover? Are we patenting actually a naturally occurring gene here, or something different? Because the distinction here is that they managed to isolate the gene, the relevant mutations of the gene. And so they're arguing that, well, it was the process of isolation that made this a novel invention.
That's right. And it is a, you know, it's a close case in the United States where this exact issue is being litigated as well against the parent company, Myriad. Two courts have looked at it and they've now been split 2-2. So two judges have said yes and two judges have said no. Mm. So it's obviously not a, you know, a completely black and white issue where the courts would be ruling in that way. The American case is very likely to go to the U.S. Supreme Court, and I hope that the decision of the federal court here will go to the Federal Court of Appeal. I should say that our federal court is renowned around the world for the quality of its intellectual property decision-making, but this is a decision that I don't particularly like myself.
Can I clarify, David, though, for our listeners? Does this mean, does this patent mean that Myriad Genetics and the Australian company, Genetic Technologies, own the genes or the relevant mutations on those genes?
Well, they own the rights to the commercial use of it. I mean, what a patent is, it says you have invented this process and in exchange for your publishing it, so it doesn't remain a trade secret, you have to publish every aspect of it and how you use it, we will give you exclusive rights to commercialize that for a period of some years. And then after that, like we know with many drugs, after a certain period, they go out of patents and then anybody can produce a similar sort of drug. So the same here. So basically what you would have to do if you want to do further research in that area or improve on it or build upon it would be to seek some sort of licensing arrangement with the patent holder.
So you'd have to pay royalties to use the technology.
That's right, and that's where it starts to get expensive. In America, and again, it hasn't been enforced here, another, I think, thing that got people very upset with Myriad is they not only wanted to charge quite a significant amount, but they were restricting the testing regimes to their own labs. And so that would have led to a loss of expertise in from public labs. Would have meant that there was lower assurances of quality, restrictions on innovation, other people looking at that and saying, well, we can do that a little bit better, a little more efficiently. So there was a kind of a double whammy, not only the cost, but also the restrictions on access.
Sally Crossing, the last time I looked at this in America, the USA company had, Myriad had enforced their patent and the test for the BRCA1 gene was only able to be done by the company and it was costing patients upwards of $3,000. And the company, in one case that Lateline reported on a few years ago, wouldn't allow the insurance company to cover it, so that the actual patient had to cover the cost of the test. Is that still the case in the USA, do you know?
Look, I'm afraid I can't tell you. I don't know because I'm more familiar with the Australian situation.
Okay.
But we have heard that it's pretty grim, and that's one of the reasons why we get so worried here, because what happens, you know, in the Big Brother area could... it's one of the threats, I suppose, of to what might... if we don't do something about this now to make it very clear to everybody, really basically what the community wants, you know, what do we expect is the right thing to do.
Well, I think the community is still working out what this all means. I'd like to bring into the conversation now on Life Matters this morning. We're talking about the question of whether private companies should be able to legitimately patent human genes and what the consequences of that are, what the benefits are for patents and the whole patenting process. Joining us now is Michelle Gallagher. She is the Chief Executive Officer of the Bio Melbourne Network, which advocates for the biotech industry in Victoria. Thanks so much for being here, Michelle.
Hello, how are you?
You rushed from the stage. We're glad to have you. Look, from the perspective of industry, and you've been following this case over the years, why should biotech companies be able to hold patents over human genetic material?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think what's important here is it's actually really terrific that these cases have been brought forward and particularly discussed in public debates within the Parliament and on shows like this, because it makes the public more understanding of the process of how discoveries come from our research labs in our institutes through the biotechnology process into the marketing process. And what's important here is this judgment, and I think also another piece of legislation that came into the Parliament last year, which was called Raising the Bar, has really sharpened the IP environment, which intellectual property environment in Australia, to ensure that we have one of the best intellectual property landscapes in the world. So what that means for scientists, what it means for biotech companies and investors in those companies, is you can be very sure that the investment of sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars in a discovery can be protected and give companies and research institutes enough time to get that product through the clinical trials into the market and recoup some of their costs.
So to clarify, what's the benefit, financial or otherwise, of this patent being upheld by Myriad Genetics?
Well, the benefit straight away to GTG, which is the small Melbourne biotech company that has the license to the patent, it means that they can continue to have the product here in Australia, but it means that all of the work that's being done in biotech companies around genetic therapies or gene therapies can continue. So if this decision had gone the other way, there would be a lot of people out there in the sector who would be sitting back thinking, well, I don't know if I really want to continue this research.
How do you know that, though?
We know that with the number of discussions that I've personally had with the companies that are investing in gene therapies and doing research in the research institutes, but it's a simple fact that no one will invest in these technologies if there's not some degree of protection to ensure that that investment can be recouped on the market. So patents are probably the critical tool in ensuring that products do get to market.
All this hinges on whether Myriad and the Australian licensee who owns the license, exclusive license to the breast cancer gene test here in Australia, choose to enforce the patent. And this has been very controversial. There was that public outcry, which we referred to earlier, when the Australian company Genetic Technologies did try to enforce the patent and tried to restrict public facilities from using the test. And that had huge implications for people.
It did, and this is a very interesting point. In the patent world, there are a lot of organisations, and not just in health and biotech, in everything, who choose not to fully exploit the patent to ensure that everyone is playing by the game rules. So there are many examples, and I think you did mention that GTG had made the gift of the patent. There are many examples of this, and there's been such in stem cell science and other areas that I've worked directly in, where companies and research institutes just don't enforce the patent or enforce it very gently in the spirit of collaboration.
So there's a deeper issue here, though, and I think many of our listeners who have commented on our Facebook page have implied this too. Is it moral? Is it morally right? It might be a good financial decision for a company to own a patent on human biological material that naturally occurs, but is it morally right? I mean, one of our listeners, Michelle, has said, I don't understand how you can patent something that occurs naturally anyway. Can I patent the stars or the numbers of pi?
Yeah, I think that's an important distinction in this court case, that what Judge Justice Nicholas was talking about was actually a process where a number of molecules were isolated, a nucleic acid was isolated from the gene itself. And I quite agree. I don't think we should be patenting things that occur naturally in life. But there are many processes in place to isolate this particular element. And sometimes it's the methodology that's most important to patent rather than the end point. So within this decision that's been made in the federal court, there's some very clear distinctions about exactly what part of this process that Justice Nicholas upheld.
Well, this is the confusion, isn't it? And it is
yeah.
quite difficult to understand this ruling, and I've had a close look at it. And as New Scientist reported last week or this week, your genes are the same, whether in a test tube or inside your body. But here you have a ruling that says the very act of removing them makes them a patentable invention. You can understand why people are perplexed.
That's true. I think the other thing that Justice Nicholas said was what had been done here was that it artificially created a state of affairs that was not natural. And that's a very important distinction here. I think what's great in this whole discussion is we're actually finding the boundary. And from a moral point of view, if talking about bioethics for a minute, I think this is a very useful discussion, and I think it's great that this case, in a way, has come to court, because in this judgment, I think we're starting to find exactly where that boundary is between what occurs in nature and what occurs because of human intervention, or, as I just said, creating a state of an artificial state. And this is very important to know for the scientific community. Our researchers out there do need to know exactly where the patent rule stands. And I think this is a very good outcome.
Some of this could sound like smoke and mirrors to listeners, I suspect.
I'm sure.
Sally Crossing from Cancer Voices Australia, you're now campaigning to have the patent law changed in Australia. What would you like to see changed?
Well, we're asking that the Australian government make an amendment to the Patents Act 1990, which clearly excludes the ability to grant patents over human genetic material in any form. Now, we think that that would cover it. Obviously, the lawyers and the legislative people need to fine-tune those words. But look, I did want to, following the discussion we've just had, I just wanted to mention quite a number of researchers are very keen that this, well, obviously keen that it be clarified, but I wanted to mention Professor Ian Fraser's view, where he says, there is no more invention in isolating and characterising isolated biological materials, which is what we're talking about, that exist in our human bodies, than in collecting and arranging a set of postage stamps. I think if it's somebody like Ian Fraser, who's had great success developing very important drugs and patenting them, sees it in this light, I think it's not just we patients and consumers who are concerned about the ethics and morality of it all.
But do you see Michelle's point that a patent is a recognition that a company has developed a process to identify and test for a very important set of mutations in these genes? The argument is that without patents, important research wouldn't be financially viable or attractive. Sally?
Well, it's already happening. I mean, it's happening. I don't agree. We don't agree that research is being hamstrung by... It is a complicated thing, isn't it? We believe the researchers need freer and easier access to human genetic material than they have. I know that this patent hasn't been enforced for some period of time, but it is the uncertainty of it hanging over everybody that makes it... We're a very innovative country, and we have fantastic research. We should remove obstacles
The argument could be made that patents facilitate research. Professor David Weisbrot, what's your response here? Is there a middle ground, perhaps, if we think about patent law? Could it be that human genetic material could be an exception in patent law in Australia?
Well, it would have to be very well defined, because what you wouldn't want to do is to look at a specific problem instance and then create a broad law that would stifle all research of the kind that we would want to go ahead. There are a whole lot of things you can do that are a bit more subtle than using the legislative sledgehammer. So, for example, who's funding the research? If it's basic research leading to discoveries, most of that in Australia is coming with public money anyway. So I don't think it's so much the case that we're going to stifle the inflow of private capital into that area. We also need to look at the readiness of licensing. Michelle mentioned that in most cases people don't strictly enforce their patents, and there's a lot of goodwill in the system. And the ALRC definitely found that. When we said we've got this problem area with the Myriad GTG patents, but please come forward and give us other examples.
But couldn't
there
we formalize?
Very, very, very few examples.
Right. Couldn't we formalize some of that goodwill?
absolutely.
I mean, is it in
absolutely.
The courts of companies to you know? I mean, it means that we're very vulnerable to what choices they make around their patents, and is that good enough?
Well, there's a certain market reality as well. I mean, look at what's actually happened with Myriad and GTG. Myriad did come up with an excellent bit of science and medicine, And if they had acted more reasonably, they probably would have made a fortune and got a lot of credit from the community. And instead, by taking this bull in a china shop approach, what they bought is worldwide non-compliance and terrible publicity, so that there are other kind of sanctions that are involved. It's also the case that governments do have a lot of power, and they really don't try to use it. So in the pharmaceutical area, we're fantastic in Australia at saying to the big pharmaceutical companies, or the small ones indeed, you have a patent, we recognize that, but if you want to get on the PBS and sell into our market where the bulk of, in the way that the bulk of our people are going to purchase your drugs, you're going to have to give us a reasonable deal. Now, the ALSC recommended that we do the same thing with patents, and so we get the government buying power involved in that. And so there are a whole lot of ways of regulating this in the public interest, but we barely nibbled around the edges at it.
Yeah, well, we'll certainly watch this with interest. I think, Sally, you're planning to repeal the case.
Well, Maurice Blackburn is considering whether to appeal, and we understand an appeal is likely, so that's good news. But, I mean, a legal case is one thing, and a public interest legal case is very important, but we basically see that it's a government responsibility to resolve this issue, which has been festering for a long time. It's not terribly difficult to resolve, although I understand there are a number of ways it could be resolved, but we at the moment are hoping that we'll get a lot of public support for our petition, which can be accessed via our website.
Okay, well, we'll watch the result of this with much interest. Thank you very much for joining us today. Michelle Gallagher, Chief Executive Officer of the BioMelbourne Network, thanks for joining us there.
No worries.
And Sally Crossing, a spokesperson for the Cancer Voices Australia Advocacy Group, and Professor David Weisbrot. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And David Weisbrot is Emeritus Professor of Law and Honorary Professorial Fellow in Medicine at the University of Sydney. Interested in your thoughts on this one? Get on our Facebook page, as many of you have, or you can email us from our webpage or our listener feedback line 02 833 1430. It's a little bit complex, but it's absolutely crucial, isn't it? This one, who owns our biology, you or someone else? Coming up, we're going to bring in a whole stack of themes, actually, a complex story about grief.
WA's Pilbara region might be driving the Australian economy.
It's becoming game on.
But now the pressure's on to exploit the rich resources of the pristine Kimberley.
When the gas plant is built, it will essentially be out of sight, out of mind.
It's a once-in-a-lifetime economic opportunity for traditional owners. But at what cost?
If the Kimberley goes under to this resource boom, God help us.
For them, it is their one roll of the dice.
Red Dirt Dreaming, 360 documentaries, this Sunday after the news at 10.
As it turns out, our next conversation pulls together two visceral themes we've delved into quite closely this week. At the Australian Psychological Society's Counselling Conference in Melbourne tomorrow, one of the sessions will focus on mental illness and grief. There's an awful lot of layers to that combination. When someone becomes sick, they can grieve for what well self they used to be and the livelihood they've lost, and others can grieve for the person you were. But there are other serious dimensions to this. People with mental illness can often become homeless. They can also become missing persons. They can also take their own life. And there again is grief, very complex grief. And joining us this morning is psychologist Jeffrey Glassock, who is looking at the particularly difficult grieving experiences of families of missing persons. Garrett O'Dowd is joining us. He's a grief counsellor who provides support to bereaved families living in the Western Metropolitan region of Melbourne. And Sarah Coker is joining us, the Suicide Prevention Project Coordinator for the non-profit health organisation SANE Australia. Sarah's been researching the often patchy services offered to bereaved families, and all this has led to a very interesting document, the SANE Bereavement Guidelines. Welcome to all three of you.
Hi, Natasha.
Thanks, Natasha.
Did I get your surname right, Sarah?
You did, yeah.
Oh, excellent. Sarah, I'll start with you. I'm thinking back to Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's Five Stages of Grief from the 1960s. They really, her model of grief gained incredible traction, but things have moved on, haven't they? How has our understanding of grief changed?
Yes, that's right, Natasha. Things have moved on quite a bit, but those original five stages have really stuck in people's minds as how people experience grief. But what we've realised now is that it doesn't always reflect people's actual experiences. The five stages imply that it's quite a linear process that people go through and that there's usually a time limit on that. But nowadays we realise that people tend to... It's a very individual experience that people go through. They don't necessarily move through stages in that order. Also that people tend to move with grief rather than move on from it. It's a highly individual experience for people.
What's that
and
distinction
it's certainly not
between,
so linear.
What's that distinction between moving through or with grief rather than on from a death or a loss?
Well, I suppose moving on from grief implies that you've left it behind, that it no longer exists. Mm. And I think for a lot of people, grief never goes away. It's more about how they learn to live their lives carrying the loss of someone with them and also carrying the memories of someone with them.
Yes. Geoffrey, I think you were a psychologist at the time of the Granfield train crash in 1977, and that was really... when quite a few key things were starting to be realised in the profession about the paucity of counselling services, wasn't it?
Yeah, as a result of the Granville train disaster, I think we understood that emergency services, workers, psychologists and other mental health professionals were inadequately prepared for dealing with traumatic loss or bereavement generally, and as a result, the National Association for Loss and Grief was established, and I guess I became involved about a year or so after that. But more recently, my involvement from a grief perspective was trying to understand the grief experience of families of missing persons. And one of the problems I discovered was that in doing the research in terms of the grief models, grief models in the main tend to be death-related. And in the 90s, I guess, as Sarah has already indicated, there's what I call a paradigm shift. We move from the phases and stages models. We move to a far more expansive model, I guess, in terms of understanding the need for a continuing bond with people who have been lost, either through death or through going missing. One of the problems that I found is if you have a missing person, what rituals are available to actually remember them? There are none. So trying to develop something which has some meaning, we developed just simply a service of remembering, and in that it's possible then to acknowledge the person who is missing and the grief that's associated with that, but not to indicate whether the person is alive or dead.
Yes, and this is relevant.
And so I came up with what I basically call a grief of missingness, which hopefully I might be able to explore a little more.
Well, let's think about that. This is relevant to this discussion about grief and mental illness, and we're coming at this from a few different prongs today, aren't we?
Sure.
And this idea of, missing 35,000 people
35,
go missing 000. Each year, and a big part of that, we think, although we don't have exact figures about this, are those with mental illness go missing.
Well, yeah, mostly, though, undiagnosed mental illness, which is the major problem. In the families that I spoke with, one of the things that became clear was that mostly the mothers, rather than the fathers, were aware of their child being somewhat different in the developmental stages and through teen years. But the mental illness, which in the main tended to be schizophrenia, was not diagnosed. And so trying to help somebody who didn't acknowledge or was unwilling to get assistance created major problems for families, particularly when in the teen years in particular, they might become violent and abusive and really threatening the lives of family members.
What is this grief of missingness that you talk about that you think is quite a distinct expression of grief compared to when someone actually dies and you know they've died?
Well, you've got a time where you can actually look to a point in the life of a person that they have died with a family member who goes missing. You're living with ambiguity, so you're living between the known and the unknown, and that's the trauma.
Indeed, it is. I'd like to bring in Garrett O'Dowd into the conversation, grief counsellor there in the Western Metropolitan region of Melbourne. Garrett, this relationship between grief and mental illness, I mean, it starts in some sense for both the person with the illness and their loved ones at the point of diagnosis, doesn't it? There's a grief associated with diagnosis.
I think there is certainly is a grief there, but often that grief is unrecognised. I suppose the grief is the loss of the dreams that they had for themselves and for their lives and for their family as well. It's the same thing, the loss of the dreams that they had for their loved one. Unfortunately, this grief is never real. I mean, we talk about it, I've worked in mental health for a number of years as well, and it's acknowledged as this grief there, but there's actually no real opportunities for people to work through and to acknowledge that grief. And it's a bit like what Jeff's saying, there's an ambiguity when people go missing. There's also an ambiguous loss that exists when people with a mental illness, when people become well with a mental illness, that the person is physically present, but psychologically they're different than they were before and they're changed. And families are going through a grief experience, but as I said, there's no real opportunities for them to really talk about that and to understand this is what's happening for them, and also how this impacts upon their relationship with their loved one, which, of course, is further complicated when that person also dies through suicide or goes missing.
So there can be a real grief of losing the person that was.
Yeah, well, it's almost like there's a lady called Susan Roos who talks about chronic sorrow, which is talking about a living loss where something which is pervasive and pervading and affects who the person is. And it's something which people carry with inside them, and it's like that heaviness that they feel. And they're not actually able to name, and nobody actually really acknowledges, because it's something which, because of the stigma around mental illness, or sometimes even shame, people actually just live with these experiences and don't understand them. And often it's only when there's been a suicide that there's opportunity not only to deal with the crisis of the suicide itself, but maybe some opportunity to understand the pre-existing grief experience that they're going through and the trauma and stress that is associated with that.
So that can be a very complicated grief experience then, if you've got those unresolved layers around, you know, that initial diagnosis and the really difficult and sometimes angry relationship that you can have with a loved one with mental illness.
Well, relationship, I suppose, is with the ambiguity, it's where people actually try the uncertainty of the loss. They actually attach and detach, trying to shift and to get the person back to how they were before. And these ambivalent feelings, you know, which do exist, are more an effort to try and restore things to how they were with the person beforehand. Of course, this complicated grief, this complicated relationship when the person dies, then becomes part of the range of ambivalent feelings people are working through and trying to make sense of when the person's died.
There is actually an emerging interest in what psychologists are calling complicated grief. What are the dimensions of that? Why distinguish it?
Well, complicated grief, I suppose, is looking at, for most people, I think about 80% of people, we can actually, if we go through a bereavement or a loss, it's very tough, very difficult, but people are actually able to work through it and manage it over time. Complicated grief is where there are obstacles to the processing of that grief, and the complications, you know, can be around ambiguity, for example. The complications can be around how the person died, and certainly death through suicide is complicated because people try to make sense of why it happened and what they could have done to prevent it. The death of a child can be a complication as well. So it's looking at things which are maybe outside the norm, outside people's assumptive world, how they think the world should be, and they become complicated because the world no longer makes sense to them, and the adjustment that is required from them is quite enormous. Also associated, that can be where the grief is disenfranchised, where other people don't recognise the grief and loss that people are going through. So these complications often mean that people need support of professionals just to work through those issues and simply to sit with the human experience and to sit with the pain they're going through, rather than trying to rush them through it and to move on and get on with life, to help them to actually understand what's happening for them and then to look at how they manage those experiences.
Sarah Coker, can I come to you? With Sane Australia, you've done a survey on how families are followed up after a person with mental illness takes their own life. And really, the picture isn't ideal, is it?
No, we did qualitative research into families' experiences after the death of someone with mental illness to suicide. One of the main findings was that families were often quite disappointed with the reaction they had from services who were treating their loved one. Often they had minimal contact after the death, and in some cases they had no contact with services at all. And I think that really impacted on their own grief process. And they felt quite, I guess, abandoned by the service who they felt were taking care of their loved one.
Mm, yes. So, the concern is that often people who have lost a loved one who had mental illness, that they are at risk themselves, aren't they?
Yes, absolutely. That's right. I mean, quite a lot of the families we spoke to, certainly there are higher risks in terms of suicide for those people, but also risks in terms of mental health. So quite a few of the people we've spoken to have gone on to develop depression or post-traumatic stress disorder. So I guess one of the main things that SANE is trying to do is to encourage services to support the families after the death of a client. So to prevent them from developing mental illness or becoming a suicide statistic themselves.
What can the service do?
Look, I think in a lot of cases it doesn't have to be that complicated. I think it's about acknowledging the grief that the families are going through. It's about offering them some time to answer their questions when they can. And it's about referring them on to appropriate services so that they can get help for their own bereavement.
Yes, and I'm interested in then what these bereavement guidelines are, because of course mm-hmm. you've just explained that grief takes all sorts of shapes and forms. Are these guidelines prescriptive? How do they work?
Certainly they're not prescriptive, because we understand that different services operate in different ways. So we wanted them to be flexible, but I suppose we're trying to drive home those main points around taking that extra step to support bereaved family and friends. And I think the friends issue is an important one, because often people with serious mental illness have friends who also have mental illness, and therefore may be quite vulnerable if a friend in their social network dies by suicide. So it's about encouraging services to maybe kick in a bit of extra support to those friends who may also be clients of the service. It's about reaching out to families, and it's also about ensuring that there's support in place for staff who in some cases have known a client for many years and could be very deeply affected themselves.
It all sounds intuitive, doesn't it? But it just doesn't happen all the time.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, look, sometimes it does happen, but I think it's often off the back of individual staff's own bat, and it's not necessarily endorsed in an organisational way. So the guidelines are about trying to encourage a formalised approach to how services respond to people who are bereaved by suicide.
Yes, indeed. Look, thank you very much for joining us this morning. It's a very diffuse conversation, isn't it? Because grief is a diffuse experience.
Absolutely. It covers so many topics.
It's different things for different people.
Mm. Yeah.
It absolutely is. And thank you very much for explaining some of your work. I mean, just the experience of missing people is incredibly complex, but I think we've just realised that mental illness and grief kind of span so many different domains. Thank you, Garrett O'Dowd, grief counsellor in Melbourne there. Geoffrey Glassock, psychologist, really focused on working with people who are missing. Thank you, Geoffrey.
Thank you.
Families of missing people, and Sarah Coker, who has developed some bereavement guidelines through SANE Australia, is actually a very valuable read. Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks, Natasha.
Thanks, Natasha. Thank
and they will be presenting at Australian Psychological Society's conference tomorrow in Melbourne. And up next, now hear this.
Listen to all your favourite RN programs on your smartphone using the free ABC Radio app. Suitable for iPhone or Android, this easy-to-use app also lets you listen to 18 other ABC radio stations, including our specialist sport, music and pop-up event broadcasts. With inbuilt links to social media sites and access to online schedules, you can find all the details on how to download this free app from the RN front page. Then simply start listening.
Do you remember some of your earliest jobs? Rod Sacklier, Ken. One of his was as a ground announcer at the MCG in Melbourne. Today, he's a technician at Parliament House in Canberra. But then, wet behind the ears, he had a go, and he was also gutsy enough to take the stage recently as part of the ABC's Now Hear This series of stand-up storytelling events that we bring you on occasion. Here's Rod on the job.
Well, it was the summer of 1989-90, a Melbourne summer. I found myself as the ground announcer at the MCG. I was 20 years old, and I was the most unqualified, out-of-my-depth ground announcer that that great establishment has had before or since. So how did I get there? I was wondering myself. A friend of mine, who a few weeks earlier had resigned, gone off to Melbourne. He said, look, he rang me up and said, look, I've got this job for you. It's only for the summer. It's the ground announcer at the MCG. You like cricket. You've got a good voice. Oh, well, yeah, why not? I've got nothing else to do. So I headed off down to Melbourne without even seeing these people who were employing me or a CV or anything. And I drove off down the highway in my HG Kingswood. And I got there and he put me up in his house with his urbane friends, and I was just going, wow, this is great, beautiful it was. And in Paran, I still don't know if I've said that right, but I got on the train out to Richmond and to the MCG for the first day, and they set me up. I met Lisa, who was the PBL, which is Channel 9's marketing arm, which was the reason I was spruiking, because I was going to be selling these magazines, Inside Edge magazine. I don't know if you've ever read it. I don't think I've ever bought a copy, even though I love cricket. But my job was to spruik, to say, you know, to come buy these magazines, which were being sold around the ground at the time. And they set me up in the press room, which has had all these hard-nosed hacks, you know, the guys who wrote about the cricket and stuff, and they sussed me from the very first moment I walked in there. They just went, what is this kid doing here? So I sat down in front of this microphone, and I had a little button. And any of you who have been to a metropolitan train station here in Australia or whatever know this sound. It's the dung-dung-dung-dung sound, which alerts you to the next announcement's going to happen. So it was exactly the same thing. It's like dung-dung-dung-dung reverberates around the MCG. And I thought, I just wish I was in some little tiny room with no one else around me, and I could just, without that noise, I could just say stuff and that would be okay. It would be much better than being announced, you know. So it was my job. They gave me a little blurb just to say, dung, 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 dung. You can find your Inside Edge magazines at these locations around the ground. This month, is Mark Taylor's bum too big? When will Alan Border end his career? Will we ever find another great spinner? That sort of thing. And there was all sorts of other stuff I had to read. It was about a page long. Quickly, I realised, well, if I hadn't already realised, that I wasn't cut out for this. I, you know, wasn't very good. And the only things I really, really liked saying were, you know, dung, 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 dung. The incoming batsman for Australia is Dean Jones, because everyone would go, rah, you know. And I thought that was pretty cool. It was a bit harder when the Sri Lankans came out, so, you know, dung, 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 Madagali Samarasekara, but I wasn't game to say that. So after a while, I only said things that I was really confident of saying and that I got a reaction that was good. At one stage, you know, because one day cricket back then, you know, wasn't great, and there was a lull in the play, and the people would do the wave and they'd throw their stuff in the air, and the ground management came in and they said, tell those people to stop throwing that stuff, or in such words. So, dung, 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 dung. Would patrons please refrain from throwing the rubbish into the ground? Boo! You know, it was just Don't ask me to say that again, please. And then on this one particular night, I think it was later in the season, I did about 6 one-day games and the test match, and it was a day-night game, and it was the biggest crowd of the summer. There was about 60,000 people there, I think. And I remember just in front of me, this little kid had noticed where all these announcements were coming from, the ones that I did. And he kept turning around because he was expecting me to say something. You know, I'd fluffed up a few lines here and there, and he was quite enjoying it, more than the cricket probably. But it was late in the summer and I hadn't really done this spruiking that I was meant to be doing. And I thought, look, I've got to do this at some stage. I think to myself, Lisa, the lady from PBL, hadn't come to see me yet, but I knew she was there. I could feel her. So I waited for a break in the play because I couldn't talk when the game was going on. And I started reading this thing. And, you know, any sane person or knew how to do this sort of thing wouldn't read the whole thing. They would sort of paraphrase and grab bits from here and there. But I just started reading it. And I was, you know, going okay, but then I started fluffing lines and cold sweats. And I thought, oh, no. And then I realised something was happening. And there was this sort of hush that started to become a murmur. And I'm going, what? Like, and that made my reading worse. And so I just sort of stopped and looked up. And there in front of me was the little kid, huge grin on his face. And further afield, there was more people who had turned around to see what was going on. And then out on the ground, there were the umpires and the cricketers all standing there looking in my general direction, waiting for me to shut up. The game had to go on. And a few more horrible seconds went by and I was just silent. And all I could think to say was, oh, shit. Whereupon I got the biggest cheer of the summer.
Well, there you go, Rod Sacklier there, telling his story at a Now Hear This storytelling night held in Canberra a little while back. And if you've got a story to tell and would like to be part of a Now Hear This coming to your neck of the woods, check out the Radio National website for more info, or the Now Hear This Facebook page, which you can search for in Facebook. And in fact, if you're in Sydney, the next Now Hear This Storytelling Slam is on next Wednesday at the Art House Hotel in Pitt Street in the heart of Sydney. And the theme is X's and Y's. Get your 5-minute story ready and turn up if you're in that neck of the woods. You can check out more details on their Facebook page. And I gather Now Hear This is set to make a bigger splash on RN this year. We'll let you know more about that. Some Facebook comments in response to our lead story on the question of whether genes should be patented. Angela writes, so if they can slap a patent on those genes, can I sue them for the presence of their genes in my body? Well, there you go. And also, Jemmy writes, upsetting, I've been told to test for it, this gene, the breast cancer gene, obviously, as my dad has the gene, but they wouldn't test me because I didn't have life insurance and I can't get life insurance because my dad has the gene. There's a hole in my bucket, dear Liza, says Jemmy. And lots more comments coming in. Liz says, with the tongue firmly in cheek, I've decided to patent the table. So there you go. Very serious issue, though, and looking forward to your continuing conversation on our website about that one. Michael Cathcart is waiting in the wings of the Radio National stage to join you for Books and Arts Daily. Good morning, Michael.
Da-da-da-da-da-da.
Get the tap. Did you ever do tap dancing?
I never did tap dancing. Are you a tap dancer,
No,
Natasha?
I wasn't, but I know Amanda Smith was a tap dancer in a past life, our colleague, body sphere presenter.
She has explored all forms of dance. She was a ballet dancer too. She used to get around in a little tutu.
I know. Amazing.
In fact,
Hidden talents.
I've seen her in a tutu. She still looks pretty flash in a tutu.
She does indeed. What have you got coming up, speaking of the arts?
Yes, it's performance arts today. We're going to the opera. We're going to talk to Lyndon Terracini, who runs Oz Opera, and find out how things are changing, because there is a view that opera's a bit of a seedy, not a seedy, a, you know, a sort of dusty, dusty, seedy. Self-satisfied, no, not seedy, but rather too respectable art form, and it needs to perhaps be a little bit more seedy. Perhaps that would make it more popular. And Julia Blake is joining. It's a wonderful actress. I saw her last night, Natasha, in a show called 4,000 Miles by an incredible playwright called Amy Herzog. It's just a wonderful, wonderful play. And I'm so excited that Julia's come into the studio. So that's what's coming up on Books and Arts.
Terrific. Thank you. Enjoy the show. Next on the Friday, Talkback for Life Matters. You know, iPads, tablets, they're kind of ubiquitous in many households across Australia. Should we be putting them in the hands of kids? Looking at that whole story. Join us with your calls. Coming up to the news now, 10 a.m.
If you're about to start fasting for 2 days a week, hang on a tick. Think for a moment. Did you give up bread, go Atkins, embrace the Beverly Hills diet? Any of that work? Well, all of it was hailed in the media. Stories about losing weight go down a treat. Indeed, if you're like most people, you probably consume a fair bit of what's called consumer health journalism on everything from diets to cancer and dementia. But most of it is wrong. Find out why on The Media Report. Now with Omega 3. abc.net.au/radio.